Seriously,
I was
like
trying to talk over my stomach going
the whammy bar on the stomach, huh? Oh my God.
You didn't know I had those talents. Now you do.
No, that's sick.
Literally, it's sick.
Yeah, totally disgusting.
I'm Alex Higley.
And I'm Lindsay Hunter. And
I'm a writer.
Writer, bud. Welcome to I'm a Writer, But. With us today is Matthew Salicis, who is the best-selling author of The 100-Year Flood, an Amazon Best Book of September and Kindle First Pick, an Adoptive Family's Best Book of 2015, and a Best Book of the Season at BuzzFeed, Refinery29, and Gawker, among others. And Disappear, Doppelganger Disappear, a Best Book of the Year at Thrillist.com. And his most recent book that just came out is Craft in the Real World, which explores alternative models of craft and the writing workshop, especially for marginalized writers. His previous books include I'm Not Saying, I'm Just Saying, Different Racisms on Stereotypes, The Individual and Asian American Masculinity, and The Last Repatriate. Welcome, Matthew. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks so much for having me.
Welcome.
And we are excited to hear you read. What do you have for us today?
I'm going to read just the very first section of the novel Disappear, Doppelganger Disappear.
Awesome.
So it's in a section called Earthquake. One night, my girlfriend asked what was wrong with me, and I couldn't explain. We lay on my black sheets between my blank white walls, on the bed that was the room's only furniture. We had bared ourselves. We had a connection when we were naked. But Sandra wanted more than full exposure. It was 3 a.m. after her late shift, waiting tables at the cave, and she smelled like fry oil and strangers, and still she talked. Who was I to prefer silence? I told her how I blacked out as I watched the news, ate my microwave dinner, wrote, how I woke to find my status update a string of G's with no likes, nothing to account for the time between. It's not just loneliness, I said. I'm pretty sure I'm disappearing. People walk straight into me on the street. When I'm alone in a bathroom with 10 urinals, some white guy will come in and pee right next to me. She twitched her mouth from side to side. This was a habit I envied. She was always doing things equally on either side of her body. When her lips parted, the smack echoed off the empty walls. How long have you been feeling like this? She asked, like you're disappearing. I couldn't tell whether she was being sarcastic. Well, these were the facts. My cat was dead. My wife and daughter had left me. At some point in the last 3 years, I'd stopped going out or having friends. After the divorce, I kept the walls blank because the echo was a kind of company. Just to clarify, Sandra said, you felt like disappearing the whole time you've been with me? Just to clarify, I said, what I mean is, you're all I have left. Maybe you're the only reason I'm still here. I felt quite smart about this line. Try again, she said. I'll just stop there.
Thank you so much. Alex and I were just talking about how is it possible that that book just came out in August of 2020? And now you have this craft book that came out. Can you explain to us how, as a father, you have two children, right? Mm-hmm. How, as a father of two and a professor, you are getting all this work done?
Oh my gosh. Badly?
No, badly? No, that's not an acceptable answer because it's not badly.
Well, you know, a lot of it was before everything went, you know, that shit. I can swear, right?
Oh yeah.
Of course, yes.
The novel is actually a few years late. It was supposed to come out in 2017, maybe 2018. Mm-hmm. And I found out my wife had cancer, and you know, it took me a while to turn it in, and then they had a kind of a long cycle on getting it out there. And in the meantime, you know, I had these, I've been writing about craft for a while and pedagogy. And so I had all of this material, right? And I'm always thinking like, okay, if I'm going to do anything, I should at least like try to do it around some kind of theme so that eventually I can use it for a book. And so I just had a bunch of this stuff and thought, you know, seemed like a good time. I think like Roxanne Gay had tweeted or something that I should, that it should be a book. And a couple of editors had tweeted back at me and I was like, you know, hint, hint, nudge, nudge. And so my agent and I put together a proposal and went out with it and it sold pretty quickly. And then things went very, it seemed like a much quicker process than the novel was. I just kind of wrote it over the summer and it was suddenly kind of coming out and just happened to coincide with the novel's timing, you know, during this worst period of time to release a book ever.
Oh my gosh.
You wrote it over this past summer? Or you put the book together over this past summer?
It was this, I guess it was the summer before. This summer was like pandemic summer, right?
Yeah. It's all one long thing for me. It's hard for me to even remember the order of the seasons anymore.
Literally tonight I was like, okay, so last year was 2019. I was like, oh, wait a minute. Oh, I got to catch up.
No, my daughter was saying she couldn't remember the order of the seasons like a couple of days ago. And I was like,
well,
yeah, we're with you.
Speaking of your daughter, you had that wonderful story that you told on Twitter. Can you retell it here about your daughter and wanting to be a graphic novelist?
Yeah, sure. So I was sitting there, you know, listening to her say this last part, and I was thinking, oh crap, this is a workshop story. I'm gonna have to tweet this now. So I bought her for Christmas a bunch of these like blank graphic novel cells books, you know, like blank graphic novel books, which you could fill with a graphic novel. Mm-hmm. And also, along with that, a bunch of graphic novels, and which are her favorite form right now. And a couple of books on how to write a graphic novel is like the McLeod books, Lydia Bendaberry books.
Mm-hmm. Oh, cool.
And I asked her just to kind of read them before she started because I thought it would be helpful to her to have some kind of like base point to jump off of. And also I was interested in the books. I thought I could always, you know, get them after her and maybe I would write a graphic novel.
You heard it here first.
And so she read them very excitedly. She got through those books in like a day or two, right? Because she was a child. And she was very excited and she started doing all these character sketches and they were really amazing. You know, she clearly picked up some stuff that was pretty interesting there. And then she also just like has a really active imagination. And she would show me these every day or two and ask how they were. And I would say, it's great. And, you know, after a while, she just kind of stopped doing it. And one day she said, I'm not good at graphic novels. I said, what do you mean? You haven't even done a how do you know you're not good at graphic novels? And she said, well, you know, like, I can't do it the way that I want to do it. I said, well, you've written like all of these other novels, what she calls novels. Mm-hmm. You've written all these other books. You know, you're always saying you're a better writer than I am because you've written a million books and I've only written 4 books. So I think it'll be fine. You know, you just kind of just get started and, you know, have some fun. And so she seemed like she was buoyed by that. But then a few days after that, she said that she couldn't do it at all and that she wasn't going to be able to do a graphic novel. And I was kind of baffled. And maybe like 4 or 5 hours after that, a long period of time for a child, but of like a short period of time really had passed. And she came back and she was like, well, what if I just don't listen to the books?
Oh.
And I was like, what? Yeah, you know, okay. And she's like, well, if I just do it like the way that I want to do it. And I was like, oh, of course. Like, that's of course how you should do it. Right? Oh, my God. I was like, oh, no, this is what's going on in her head, right? Like, she's like thinking, this is the way I'm supposed to do it. And now that I can't do, you know, like, I feel like I can't do it that way. And so I can't do it at all. Right.
Oh.
And so as soon as I said this, you know, like, her, she's lights up and she's like off to work. Right. And now she's already written a couple of pages of this graphic novel.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. It's just,
it you
just
freed seems... her. You freed her.
Did she tell you pure craft is the lie after that?
She did. Yeah. Yeah.
That's have awesome. You heard the story about, I heard Linda Barry talk about when she wrote Cruddy, that she had sold the novel, I think, before she had written it, and she didn't know how to start. And so she kept asking herself, well, how would I write a novel if I was writing the novel? And she finally realized that she was the person writing the novel, and she decided that she would paint it first, that that's how she would write a novel, is she would paint it, and then she would write it from that. So it's like... Your daughter was reading Linda Barry, right? And it seems like it's kind of, you know, Linda Barry freed herself just as you freed your daughter. And yeah. It dovetails so perfectly with what the book's getting at, right? With what Craft in the Real World is getting at.
Yeah,
is
it's crazy.
We have been imprisoned by these tropes that were never intended to be, you know, all that freeing in the first place, right?
Right.
And especially as someone, you know, from a marginalized, you know, group of people in this. Yeah. I don't know. I thought that was so charming. And I feel like that's a realization that, for me personally, took a really long time to come to, which was like, oh, I'm the one who's doing this. Like, I'm not Alice Munro. I'm not A.M. Holmes. Like I'm the one.
It's hard when you've also got to realize that you are an I. Like, I feel like that's the hard part.
Oh right. My gosh, that's so
I'm
true.
The one, but who am I?
Yes, and that is actually a quote that I sent Alex from your preface. I'm just pulling it up here. Like in Revision, the fiction writer must break down what she thinks she knows about her craft in order to liberate it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, it's sort of getting to like the I, right?
Yeah, totally. I was teaching this course about desire in the fall. And we started off talking about Lacan because I don't actually spend a lot of time in class on Lacan, but I do want to kind of just talk about him a little bit because I think he's funny and his ideas are interesting. And so I was telling them, you know, he has this thing about like, you like form yourself from the, and I give him this like graphic thing from like a, it's like a graphic introduction to Lacan. And it's like this woman lying on the bank of a like pond or something. And in the pond are like all the words other people use to describe her. And it is kind of like that, right? You like, first you define yourself by like the limits of what other people are telling you you are. And it's hard to kind of figure out like, well, what do I actually want to be, and how do I, you know, take ownership of these things that are been limiting me mostly my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think like a lot of writers, do I even like have the right to take that kind of ownership? You know, like, am I worthy? Am I good enough? I mean, maybe I'm like dragging myself here. But you know, like it, when you're, you know, when you're, it's sort of similar to what happened with your daughter, is like, you were being told to read these things for certain reasons, but then we might start telling ourselves like, well, but that's not what I do.
Yes. Yeah. Oh yeah. Actually, I remember now when I said, you've written all these novels, you know, she said, yeah, but I really love graphic novels. And so that's why I can't do it.
Oh,
like, because she was more invested in it.
Oh right. My gosh.
She could do the novels because
it mattered too much.
Fun. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's beautiful.
I wonder if that's just related to audience too. I mean, are you her first reader? Are you the one, you know, it's like the parts, I haven't read the entire book yet, but the parts that have been really striking to me and like kind of breaking my brain are the ones related to audience and how limited in some ways or open your audience can be and how freeing that can be. I loved even just where you were saying, you know, you call yourself an Asian American writer writing for an Asian American audience, I believe, but that's not necessarily, you know, everyone you're teaching or everyone who's necessarily going to be reading the book, but I don't know. I'd really like to hear just how you kind of arrived at even that understanding of, you know, being freed up in relation to understanding your audience or who you wanted your audience to be or something.
Yeah, sure. It's actually, I was thinking of this same story when you were talking about the Barry thing. So I sold Disappear, Doppelganger Disappear on spec after the 100-Year Flood came out. And, you know, in that month of time when it was doing really well before, you know, everything just suddenly comes to a complete stop. Mm-hmm, And so it seemed like a good time to do things. And so I sold the novel on like an outline in 50 pages.
Wow.
And I thought this would be like the greatest thing in the world, right? Like then it's not hanging over your head. You don't have to worry about selling the actual novel. You know, they can't take it back, I think. Maybe.
Let's never find out.
Can't take it back now.
But actually, it was so pressuring in a different way. You know, I didn't have the pressure of like selling the book, but instead I had the pressure of like realizing that I had written the last book to sell the book, right? Like I suddenly realized my audience for the last book had been an editor at some random house, not random, but you know, whatever.
Some random house.
And make it a real book, right? And now that that was off the table, like, why was I even doing this? Like, who was it? Who would it be for? Who was I writing for? And it took me like a couple of years of just sitting at my desk and writing, you know, thousands of terrible pages before I could even figure out like why I was doing it and what I wanted the book to be. And that kind of process of going through all of that questioning is a large part of the craft book. I was doing that and then also kind of talking with my students as you do, right? As a kind of integrating those worlds together. And they were having the same kind of questions, right? About like, there was a lot in the news about appropriation, and we talked a lot about who's writing, who had like permission to write certain things, what gives you permission to write certain things, who you're writing for then, like when you are kind of, right? So it was all kind of in the air, and I was kind of dealing with it from all these different sides at once. I've forgotten the question now, but
I mean that was was it a process of understanding who you were not writing for that led you to understand who your intended audience or your audience would be? I don't want to put words in your mouth. I want to hear your words about it. But how did you? Was it just a process of saying like, okay, well, this one's not for an editor at some random publishing house?
It was kind of it was that realization, and then, you know, I was also at the time, for a little while I had like a kind of love hate relationship with writing reaction pieces to whatever bad news came out. And I did that for like a year, maybe a year and a half, and you know, now the stuff in my bio is all from like, you know, because those are very publishable. but it ended up just being like really defeating. I thought, you know, I was in it to like change people's minds, I thought. But the more the articles got shared on Facebook or whatever, the less I felt like they were going toward changing anybody's mind, and the more I felt like they were just kind of like giving catharsis to people who already agreed with me. And I still worry about that catharsis. I worry like that. I just wrote this essay about this, but like getting that release actually gets in the way of using that energy toward activism. And so I just felt like I had to get out of that. And I also felt like, oh, I'm writing all of these articles like basically for my white adoptive parents and to try to like convince them that I am like a good reason for them to like get on board the leftist whatever revolution train. Right. You know, that wasn't working either. I mean, once I'd written this whole essay about difference as a good thing and how when I was growing up, my my parents wouldn't think of me as Asian because they thought of me as like their son, and that, and for some reason those things weren't, you know, they couldn't happen at the same time. So I wrote this whole article about it, and my dad read the entire thing and then sent me on a message on Facebook that said, "I don't know, I read it. Good job. I still think of you as it was just my son and not me." I was like, "Oh my gosh!" And it just felt like, "Oh, I guess this is not really not going to work. I'm going to like
he's not your audience." This.
Well, he was, you know, and I realized I was writing to an audience of my parents basically, and I had to change it.
That's so interesting. So,
yeah.
It's truly amazing. I feel like we should have an anthology of moments when you tried to connect and it just like they had a force field up around them. I'm just thinking about moments with my own family, you know, like we should we should parse that because it's intense.
It is very intense.
Do you remember, was there like a moment or like a time when you had a realization that the audience, that you had figured out who the audience you were writing to was for your novel?
Closest to it in a couple of points. There was a point in AWP where I was asked to read the manuscript in progress for the Doppelganger novel. And it was like, I was reading Sharif Shanahan, was reading somebody else, but it was just like a full crowd of almost all people of color, which like, I don't know. I started going to AWP in like 2006 and it was all white people. I mean, it was just so white.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. I've never actually seen a crowd that, you know, that diverse before at AWP. And so it really kind of blew my mind, and reading to that crowd, I felt like, oh, I'm actually, this is like who I'm talking to. And then the other time when I felt it was, I taught at Kundiman for a summer, the Kundiman retreat for Asian American writers. Mm. And it was a really transformative experience, or maybe not transformative, but a very emotional time. I just found out my wife had cancer, and they were like, you can push it off. And I was like, no, let's just like do it. And when I got there, it was just this huge like love fest, but also like a lot of kind of dealing with trauma. Mm. Everybody was crying. There were tears everywhere. Mm. You know, I was crying. And I just felt like, oh, this is like this kind of moment that just can't exist, right, in a space where you feel like even 1% unsafe.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This is sort of like what I want my novel to occupy.
Are you seeing, like, I feel like it's been an ever broadening discussion, like in social media, or like an ever broadening awareness. Do you see that happening in your workshops? Do you see, you know, like white students making space, you know, like, is there any sort of change that you're, I guess I'm asking if there's any good news that you're seeing as a professor?
I think there's lots of good news.
Okay.
There's lots of good news in people. I think the students, I mean, maybe it's just because I haven't been an undergrad for so long, but there's so much more with it and like alive and engaged than I ever was when I was 18. It's just like it's night and day.
Wow.
And so that gives me a lot of hope. I mean, not everybody, of course, is, you know, as kind of up to date with where politics are going, where kind of hopefully at least like the society of the mind is going, and but people are pretty open to it, and they're like fluent in things that for me still seem difficult, just being old now, I guess. Like, I'm not that old, but it seems really old compared to the undergraduates.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the terminology that they are using too, that like they're very fluent in just being able to kind of talk about all of these issues without feeling any of the shame. I think that even amongst, you know, people like-minded of my age, probably our age, that's there, right? Like there's like that kind of awkwardness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I do think there's a lot of hope there. Workshop-wise, I don't know. I'm not sure about the workshop per se.
Mm.
I actually think the difference for me is like when I was going to my first workshop, it was in college, and I think it was in college, and I just had no idea what to expect. And so everything seemed new, but my students seemed to have like a really, like some kind of solid idea of what a workshop is already in popular culture, but also sometimes in experience. So there's a little more of a expectation of like what it's supposed to be like that we have to work around, that I have to work around in order.
Did they use the word earn a lot? Like, I don't think you've earned this.
Yeah, oh they God. Do use that sometimes. I mean, I've banned it now.
What else have you banned?
there's a part of my syllabus is in there, and there are things that I've banned. Relatable. I've banned relatable.
Oh, likable.
Likable. I've banned kind of trying to ban like I want statements.
Yeah.
You can't even imagine how often all those statements start with I want.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Every time I think, oh, who cares? Who cares what you want?
I wish I would have been in a workshop with you.
I know. Yeah. Where?
My goodness.
Where can we sign up? I think there's also a tendency for people to come into it automatically wanting to be critical, right? Like in talking about what's lacking or what's wanting in a piece, which is so subjective, rather than talking about like what they see in a piece or what they like about a piece, which I think can be a lot more informative and useful to the writer.
You know, there's so many things in Craft in the Real World that I just wish even I had gotten a packet of some of the highlights of this before I went to grad school. I mean, things like expectations belong to an audience is really kind of like an amazing, powerful statement that even it's amazing how many of these things I've just underlined thinking like, oh my God, right. That's right. it's a specific audience I'm writing for, whether or not I realize it or not. In so many ways. I mean, you know, I've thought about it a little bit more since graduating, but my goodness, going into school, I wish my mind had been a little bit more on that track.
I know, but we were so young.
Yeah,
I think about how young and dumb I was.
Yeah.
Yeah, I am. I was, you know, an idiot.
I know, it's painful to think back.
Yeah, it seems like blissfully an idiot though, you know, I didn't.
Well,
even
yeah. Right, you're just like stomping around like I'm gonna write, you know, like and you know, eventually
I'm gonna be famous.
Yes, it's so easy to be famous as a writer, you know.
Oh my God,
that'll be me. It seems like you had a lot of fun writing this craft book. Am I wrong?
Well, I don't know, I guess. What makes you think that?
I don't know, there's like such a, maybe it's the confidence.
That's what I was thinking, Lindsay, the confidence. It feels like such a complete work in some way. It feels like, I think even somewhere you mentioned that you intended to be a conversation starter or, you know, kind of a starting place, but it really does feel like such a fully thought out approach. I don't know. Approach isn't even the right word, but yeah, the confidence definitely comes through.
That's all I know for now. I've actually been feeling bad in these interviews because I get asked these questions and I don't have any better answers than are in the book. You know,
no,
that's fair. That's such a fair answer.
Then I start answering, and then I look in the book later, and I'm like, oh, this. I just said exactly the same thing that they're asking me about in the first place.
No, that's fine. That's perfect. That's exactly valid. What people want.
Absolutely.
What is your?
There were points in the book, in the writing, where I was giggling to myself, I guess.
Yes.
Where? Do you remember where?
I'm not sure. There are things that I have like pet peeves against in the writing world, like the kind of the person who comes in, they're paid like $5,000 to talk to a, you know, a graduate school. And they just go up there and they're like, well, you just know it. You know it.
The mystics.
You wake up in the morning. Yes. Oh my gosh.
It drives yes. me
crazy. Like you've been paid so much money to do this.
Right.
Look, just let it come to you. The muse trust will float down.
Or like, I heard a voice in the woods and I just recorded it and that's the book.
I spent way too long of a time like wondering why that wasn't happening to me. You know, like before it's like, oh no, I just have to work. I just have to actually do work. Oh, okay. I get it now.
Why am I not hearing the voices?
Please, I'll do anything. I'll do mushrooms. I want to know. Oh, sorry, Alex.
I was just going to say, related to that, I have a vivid memory of my first workshop with Stuart Dybeck, who I love. But I remember thinking, he would walk in and he would be like, you're saying, like a mystic, or like it was like, you know, I'd read all these stories and I was like, oh my God, like, what is this going to be like? And he came in the room and he was just wearing white New Balances, just like every other person I'd, you know, seen. Yeah, just that, completely nude. And I remember thinking, like, he's just wearing like normal ass shoes. Oh, he's like a human. And like, it really like broke my brain. I was like, oh yeah, okay, maybe I can write a story too. I'll just have to get some New Balances, but
normal ass shoes.
Yeah.
Poor Stuart.
That's the lucky charm. Yeah. When I was in my PhD program, one of the professors was saying, he'd sent out his first manuscript, he was a poet, to all of these different places and Times New Roman, been rejected everywhere. And he was like, you know what? I'm just going to change it to Garamond. And then he changed it to Garamond and he won like three different contests at once.
And he was like,
that's the key, guys. Change it to Garamond. I was like, I'm filing this away and I'm never going back to Times New
Roman.
That's
it. That's all you need. I submitted my most recent novel in Ariel. And
oh my god!
And I was like, "Oh no, that's terrible! What was I thinking?" I'll never do that again. No, I double spaced it. Okay. I write in single space, Matthew. We talk about this from time to time, but no, I double spaced it for you know ease. But it was Ariel. God, that's so mortifying. I'll never live that down. What is your Matthew? What is your like your writing day like? How do you get work done?
Well, it's a good question.
Thank you.
I haven't gotten that much work done during the pandemic. I've been doing a little more since the semester was over. Just kind of waking up at very late points in the morning and then eating lunch. and then just trying to sit down and work, until I have to start cooking dinner for the kids.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a good like 3-4 hours in there probably. Looking at revising a novel right now. And so I need those big chunks of time and I just can't get them during the school year.
Is it a novel that you've already sold or?
No, it's about a kind of Jeremy Lin type basketball player.
Yes.
And K-drama, Korean drama.
Cool.
And cancer.
Yeah. Wow. That sounds wonderful and harrowing. And I'm glad that you're getting to work on it.
What I really want is to like have the book optioned as a K-drama.
Hell yeah.
Oh, yes.
There are a couple of just K-dramas in there that I have had ideas for that I think would be good TV shows. And they take up a part of the book just as like summaries of what the show would be like.
That's awesome.
I can't wait to read it.
Oh, thanks.
It's long been my dream to be, because, you know, V.C. Andrews, I read like all V.C. Andrews books when I was in middle school. Mm-hmm. But she died after she wrote the first book. So then it was just like a series of other writers that they would hire to pretend to be V.C. Andrews. Mm-hmm. And I want to be the new V.C. Andrews.
Cool.
I think I would be.
Pitch that to somebody.
Yes. If anyone's listening, put me in, coach. Well, thank you so much for talking to us, Matthew.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If people want to find you, where should they go?
I'm on the Twitters.
Oh.
At Salesis.
Beautiful.
Talking about kids usually.
Perfect. Your daughter is so wonderful.
This is my life now. You know, I haven't left the house since March.
Oh, I'm with you.
I'm on the same tank of gas that I was on in March.
Are you kidding?
True? Is that for real?
Yeah, yeah, I am.
Oh my God. No, you're not.
I am.
That's a good first sentence right there.
Have you tweeted that? Because I feel like that's going to go viral immediately. That is.
No, I have tweeted that. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't have thoughts that I don't tweet anymore.
Well, if you're on the same tank of gas, I think that's fair, bud.
Wow. Okay. Well, I applaud you for that.
Thank you.
Please tag us when you have to refill so that we know.
I'm getting low. I mean...
Thank you.
I think often about like the zombie apocalypse and like how long a tank of gas could actually go in the zombie apocalypse.
You'll be the last one standing. Can you write a craft book on how not to use too much gas?
One tank of gas.
Well, don't have friends.
Okay. You know, okay. Don't go to the party.
Have your groceries delivered.
Okay, these are good tips. I'm going to write them down. Thank you. We'll see you on the Twitter.
Thank you. Have a good night.
You too.
Bye. He's a lot of fun. Yes. The book is Craft in the Real World. And Alex and I got to have a little sneak preview of it, and it's been blowing our minds. And there's nothing more fulfilling than reading someone who's at the top of their game talk about their game, right? Mm-hmm. Like,
no, it's great. I'm excited to finish the whole thing. I wish I would have had time to read the whole thing before Matthew came on. But yeah, it's true. I was going through just like, I mean, we were texting little bits back and forth, and yeah, check it out.
Yeah, I think it's high time that the workshop space is sort of revolutionized. And he makes clear that, you know, this is for him, it's the start of the conversation. It's not the end of the conversation.
Right.
And, you know, like I think writers tend to fear the workshop, or they tend to feel like they're going into the shooting gallery or something, you know, like, and it shouldn't feel that way. It doesn't have to be painful. It should be useful.
Yeah. I think, it's funny. I think that when it is painful, or when you know, people have kind of gnarly workshop stories, a lot of times, you know, you're hearing someone who has been motivated just by like rage after the fact, basically, or like grudges. So it's nice to have a very different approach in Matthew's book.
Yeah. And I think anytime, you know, I've been in workshops where I've been told rules and I just couldn't understand why they were rules or where they had even come from. And I think it's important to hear, you know, a writer say, well, you don't have to pay attention to those rules, you know, like those rules aren't really rules, you know?
Right.
And I really love, he touches on in the book, how like plot looks different in different cultures, and right. that is valid. And that is actually pretty exciting, right? Like,
yeah, anyway, I mean, there's exciting stuff on almost every page for sure.
Yeah. How was your week?
Yeah, it's been pretty good, I guess. Good, decent. I don't know. I was thinking like, I don't know how to answer any of these questions.
It just started like, going downhill. It was like, it's been pretty good. It's been good. Yeah. Decent.
I was thinking today as I was walking the dog, I was like, I think this has been an okay week for a horrible year, longer than a year. What am I talking about? It's just the same. It's like, it just feels like the same.
It is. It's like you want to rage against something, but there's nothing to rage against. I mean, you can, but there's like nothing that anyone can do other than just like wait.
Yeah.
And I saw like, Dr. Fauci said, oh, well, you know, live music might be possible in the fall. But last spring he said school would be possible in the fall. So it's like, I don't trust any of that.
No, I don't trust
the notion that we'll be able to stand amongst each other and see live music in the fall is starting to feel further and further away. But maybe we'll start to feel better when like real people are doing real jobs. I don't know.
I don't know. I've internalized so much of like, okay, not doing anything. I can't imagine going to a concert in the fall. I mean, right? There's no way.
Leave my house? What?
Yeah, I don't know.
Although I am leaving my house more than Matthew. Shishirama.
Yeah, that was
impressive.
That was impressive.
The dedication to.
I thought he was kidding. I thought to Me be. Too. Yeah, I thought he was kidding. I think I can't even guess how many times I've filled up, but I mean, going to work and stuff. He's obviously been working remotely, so. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my goodness.
What about you're still on your writing break?
Yeah, I'm just still reading, which has been really fun. Doing audiobooks on the way to work and then trying to read before bed.
And you're reading Tom McAllister's book right now.
Yep. I'm doing that one right now.
How to be safe?
How to be safe. It's Shout pretty out
Tom McAllister.
It's pretty heavy. I mean, everyone has like a connection to the school shootings just because, you know, mm-hmm. of the world we live in, the country we live in. But it's funny because it's really making me think about my uncle. My uncle was one of the first photographers at Columbine when it happened.
Oh my gosh.
Because I grew up in Colorado and he lived in Littleton and was able to get, he was an AP stringer, my uncle Kevin. And, whoa. He passed away a couple of years ago, a long time ago, but anyway, he was one of the first photographers on the scene and he actually had the cover of Newsweek that Columbine, the week that it happened. If you look it up, if you type in Columbine Newsweek, it's the pictures of three students exiting Columbine, and the headline is "Why" across the front.
Oh.
But it was funny. I always have a strange feeling with Columbine because, you know, growing up in Colorado, it like felt so close, but then it was like this kind of amazing moment for my Uncle Kevin because he got the cover of Newsweek, which is like really insane for just an AP stringer photographer, you know?
Yeah.
So it was kind of a weird thing in our family. You know, like we have like so many copies of that Newsweek, but yeah, it's really, it's a heavy book, but I'm really loving it.
I can't wait to read it.
Yeah.
I'm all in. Although I don't know.
You said you're reading some really heavy stuff right now.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I've been darting around with heavy stuff. I just, a couple weeks ago, I finished reading Dancing with the Octopus, which is a memoir of a crime. The author was abducted when she was 14, but also kind of grew up in an abusive home. And it's like very like very clear, crystal, moving, poignant, great book about these terrible things. And, so I really enjoyed that, but now I'm reading this book called This Is All I Got, which is a nonfiction about a single 22-year-old mother in New York City in 2015, like trying to find a home because she's been in a ward of the state and in the shelter system for as long as she's, you know, been around. So it's harrowing, you know, like she's just one of thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands in New York City who are going through the same thing with infants.
God.
And anyway, so I that's probably like my main cause that I try to right. support is homelessness and homeless women in particular.
What was that great organization?
Sarah's Circle. Right, yes, Sarah's Circle. Hey everyone. We keep trying to give you our books. I'm going to try to give you some books. Yeah. If you donate to Sarah's Circle, which some of you did when I called to action, is that what people say? When I asked you to in sure. December and I sent out books then. I've got some more books with your names on them if you want to donate to Sarah's Circle in Chicago, which is a place that finds safe housing for women, either homeless women or women coming from violent situations in their home.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful. And I look forward to physically volunteering there as soon as they open that back up.
Awesome. They've
closed it during COVID. Anyway, writing, reading.
Did you get any work done?
I was such a badass this past week with my work. Yes.
Nice.
I was writing whenever I had a free moment.
Nice.
Well, that's a lie. 'Cause I did spend one of my nap times cleaning my house, which I think is a classic thing that all writers do when they're, you know, like avoiding writing. But I wasn't avoiding writing. It was more that like I desperately needed to vacuum and like wipe things down,
right,
and listen to You're Wrong About podcast in my earbuds.
AirPods, little golden retrievers in yours.
They should be called AirPods. Oh,
it's an improvement.
Is that a spoonerism that I just did?
Yeah, sure.
But anyway, yes, I have been having a hard time, like really, like I mentioned this before, that like so much. Since I can't hit the work every day because of just, you know, COVID and my children and, you know, life, that it's hard. It's harder to get back into it, you know, on the days that I do get to write. But I have, like, I've refound my groove.
Nice.
And I'm like fully reconnected to it and like feel more, ownership.
Is it still new pages or are you going back? Like you said, wow. Okay, cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I keep thinking I'm going to stop and go back, but then the writing just keeps coming and it keeps coming. Like I'll think like, all right, I'm going to wrap this up. And then it just keeps going and going and going. And I know that like some of that is going to be cut because I'm like getting myself to the point that it needed to get to, but, I forgot what I was going to say. Anyway, it's feeling good. It's feeling good. Like, oh, I was going to say, like, there's that gross feeling that all novelists feel where like it feels good. And then you kind of feel weird about it. And then you get back into it. It feels good. And then you kind of feel like it's not even yours. I don't know if that happens right. to everyone, but it's just like, what is this? You know, right. like, is this me? I guess it kind of goes back to what Matthew was talking about. Like, who is me? What is the
Who is me?
He says it so much more eloquently.
I fuck it. Who is me? Oh, man. Well, we know the title of the book.
I'm going to start coughing. You know, who is me? Really, at the end of the day,
I
who
love
is
it.
Me? Okay. Anyway, I'm feeling better about it is all I'm going to say.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I have 101 pages now.
Single spaced.
Yeah.
Oh my Lord.
Yeah.
That's like 7,000 pages. Double
spaced. Yep. 101. Okay. Listen, it's actually 100 pages and then like 3 sentences. So
I love that you had to own up to that. Like, this is my truth. Jesus.
Well, you guys might know. I don't know.
No, we definitely don't know.
Anyway, you were going to read a poem.
Yeah, I'm going to read a poem. A friend of mine made me aware of this, was mentioning poems that he really loved, but that were maybe lesser known. And he sent this one. And I was like, oh, my Lord, this is beautiful. So I'm going to read this poem by a guy named John Newlove, and the poem is called Driving. You never say anything in your letters. You say, I drove all night long through the snow in someone else's car, and the heater wouldn't work, and I nearly froze. But I know that. I live in this country, too. I know how beautiful it is at night with the white snow banked in the moonlight. Around black trees and tangled bushes, how lonely and lovely that driving is, how deadly. You become the country. You're by yourself in that channel of snow and pines, whether the pines and snow flow backwards and smoothly, whether you drive or you stop or you walk or you sit. This land waits, it watches. How beautifully desolate our country is, out of the snug cities, and how it fits a human. You say you drove. It doesn't matter to me. All I can see is the silent, cold car gliding, walled in, your face smooth, your mind empty, cold foot on the pedal, cold hands on the wheel.
Mm. Okay. Now that feels like a story that you wrote.
Isn't that like
that Alex Higley wrote? I'm talking about Alex Higley. Like that's a story Alex Higley wrote.
I don't know. I wish that is beautiful.
It is really beautiful. And also I love, I love reading wintry things in the winter, you know,
like, I agree. Oh my it's just goodness, like, yes.
Pull it up around me like a blanket.
I want to write a winter novel at some point. That would be a dream, a total dream. Oh my goodness.
It's in you.
Hope so. Do you have anything you want to read?
Yeah, I'll read. Oh, I almost spilled my tea. I'll read a little bit of what I've been doing. This is part of this longer portion where Cece, who's the daughter of the murdered woman, is a grown up and she's kind of realizing that she could get in touch with Jason, who's the son of the woman who had her mother murdered, and they were in love when they were, you know, teenagers. So she's like reached out to him and they're kind of messaging back and forth. And then she's also kind of a mess. So she's at her company happy hour and gets into some, you know, some stuff. So
cool.
I'll just start there. Serena, her coworker's name was, newish and eager the way Cece used to be. She'll learn, they all said to each other, jaded laughs covering up the rage, but in a shoddy way, the way you might cover a corpse with an Afghan. Cece had gotten stuck in the corner somehow, a rookie mistake, because she'd have to ask six people to shove over if she needed to pee or to escape, and Serena was one of them, so close that Cece was sitting on half her purse and Serena's elbow kept digging into her ribs. It didn't take long for Serena to be drunk, too drunk, her V-neck splotched with the Midori sour she kept missing her mouth with, the V so stretched out, so painfully overworn that Cece could see that she wasn't wearing a bra and didn't even need to. Poor Serena, she had no idea. Cece crossed and then double crossed her legs, squeezing the urine back into her body, or so she told herself. I've been messaging my high school boyfriend, she said, mainly to Serena, her strategy being that if she turned the attention onto herself, maybe Serena would quit it with the drinks, and maybe she could get some water into her so she'd have to pee as well, and they could both ask everyone to shove over, and then Cece could go out into the cold and walk the mile back to her apartment, freezing herself into sober enough. What? Serena said. She looked at Cece, and just for a second, Cece saw that she wasn't actually drunk, or she wasn't as drunk as she was pretending. There was a shrewdness, a fear, that Cece recognized as a young woman's determination to hang in, to prove herself in these rituals that seemed male-dominated or just male in general. Drink, drink more, now drink some more. Now be a fool, but don't embarrass yourself, and do it without seeming ugly. The waitress brought more drinks, and Cece saw that she looked exactly like Jackie, the low ponytail and the eye rolling and the pretty tired face. And then Cece wondered if she truly remembered what Jackie looked like. Didn't she have curly hair, bigger boobs? Didn't she have her fingernails manicured toward the end there? Or were her fingers short and stubby like the waitress's? What did you say? Serena said, and it was clear she made an effort to slur. Cece felt impatient that Serena didn't know anything about her, that there wasn't a shorthand between them, because she wanted desperately to say, that looks like Jackie, and for Serena to have a certain look on her face when she said it. But that was why she messaged Jason in the first place, wasn't it? Because he knew everything. She looked down at her phone and there was nothing. She could get up and climb onto the table and stomp over everyone's drinks and be out of there in a heartbeat, in two shakes like her mom used to say. And she could at the very least call her father. She could say what happened and she could say, I miss her so fucking much. And she could let it land like a brick to his head because she had never allowed herself to hurt him like that. Not ever. Because if she did, he'd know there was no turning back. And even though that was true, Cece needed to know that there was someone out there that hadn't given up on her. What? Serena said, her face shaped into something conspiratorial, something in on it, and Cece felt for her. Felt for Rosalind stuck humoring Will in his endless chatter about politics. Felt for Shari and the way she had to baby everyone because she was in HR and she couldn't seem too threatening. Felt for Mickey and Sarah and Britt and Fabiola and Amika because all of them said sorry before they began speaking. And Cece said it too. All of them falling over themselves to have a say without saying it too loudly, too bluntly, too readily. Or maybe Cece was just thinking of her conversations with Jason. All of them, the polite and sassy and funny messages, all of them poor masks for what she actually meant. I need you. She opened her Facebook app and wrote it and sent it. And then she drank Serena's drink and asked for another and another and another. And by last call, it was the drunkest of them left. And Cece played one round of spin the bottle in which the bottle landed on Serena and their teeth clashed together and their tongues slipped around. And Micah and Zach cheered them on and high-fived. She did walk home, the cold burning her cheeks and the toes of her boots wet through. She'd never thought too long about how Jackie was somewhere out there. What was the point? Where did it leave her? The ice and snow was loud under her footsteps, so loud that it sounded like violence. Her lips felt chapped and bruised. Idly, she thought about killing Jackie, driving to where she was, murdering her. How? That felt like too much to consider, and she was so very tired. It was fine. All of it was fine. No harm actually done. None of them would remember it come Monday. I'll stop there.
Man, oh man.
It just goes on. I mean, she's, there's more. Anyway.
I loved a young woman's determination to hang in.
That's right.
I really got her. I really could see her when you said that.
Poor Serena.
Oh God.
Anywho, I'm going to keep going. You're going to keep reading.
Going. Sure. I'm going to keep reading.
And then we'll talk to everyone next time.
Talk to everyone next time. Who is me?
Try to figure out who is you.
Yes. And who
and
is me?
And read Matthew's book because it says all of what we're trying to say. And
much better.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.
I'm a Writer But is recorded by Alex Higley and me, Lindsay Hunter, in our respective basements. Because there's a pandemic out there, please wear a mask. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Editing by Lindsay Hunter. Music by Max Loop.